The draft is going to be here in 2 years. It'll be wrapped up in 2 years. And the expectations are that a million people will come to D.C. or will participate as spectators at the NFL draft in 2027. 3 days. That would be an average of about 333,000 a day. It's obscene to even think about those numbers, but they certainly seem possible after what we've seen the last couple of years, especially in Detroit. And a week from tomorrow, the NFL schedule will be unveiled. To talk about these things and a lot more, my good friend, John Orand. John is a columnist, a correspondent for Puck News. You can follow John on X on Twitter, at Orand underscore Puck. You can read him at Puck News. He does a great job with a podcast called The Varsity, where you can get that wherever you get your podcasts. He joins us right now. So before we get to 2027 and the draft here, just tell me real quickly the final numbers, if you have them, from Green Bay in terms of attendance. And then I'm assuming it was another, you know, crazy ratings number television-wise.
Yeah, I mean, the whole point of the draft, Kevin, is like you just have to get these storylines that run through. And the Shedeur Sanders being a storyline just made people tune on day two, and especially on day three. I mean, if you recall, back in 2020, I don't have the exact numbers in front of me, but I wish I had pulled them before this. But in 2020, that was the COVID draft, you know, when everybody was Zooming, Roger Goodell was Zooming from his basement. And there was nothing else on television, no NBA playoffs. And so the viewership for 2020 will almost never be matched at all. And this year was number two by far. And day three of this year, because of that storyline of Deion's kid, was the most watched day three in the history of the NFL draft. and so it was, what ends up really working on this is, you know, people like you and me are going to sit and watch, you know, the first couple of rounds and try to figure out what teams are going to get. But, you know, all of a sudden my wife will walk into the room and she will see a draftee break down crying when he gets picked. And then she'll get sort of drawn into the storyline there. And having this one massive player just continuously drop was a big enough of a storyline that people really tuned into it.
My wife walked through our family room where the draft was on Thursday night, and she just said, "Oh, the draft is on tonight." And I said, "Yep, and it's on tomorrow night, and it's on Saturday." And then she quickly looked at the screen and she said, "Oh my God, what are they doing?" I said, "They've been doing this for a few years now. They hold these things in cities." And I said, "There are 250 to 300,000 people there." And she said, "In Green Bay, Wisconsin?" And I said,
"Isn't that crazy?"
Yes. Yes. And she goes, "Who would do that?" And I said, "Well, a lot of people apparently will do this." So how is a million a reasonable number for D.C. in 2027?
D.C., Maryland, Virginia, and the beauty of what Green Bay taught us. Also, you saw this in Nashville a couple of years ago, is that people come in for this event. I mean, it's not quite a Super Bowl, let's be honest.
Yeah.
But you have markets that go out there and really bid on having this event. And just really the idea that this was announced in the Oval Office shows that it's, you know, all 32 NFL teams want to be able to host a draft. And one of the things locally that I'm still sort of getting my head around, we haven't seen this in 25 years. In 25 years, we were kryptonite to any big NFL event. Because partly because the NFL just didn't trust the ownership that was here to pull off the event and make it work. And we now have a competent, I don't know what's going to happen over the next 10 years, but there's a sense that we have a really competent ownership in place that makes it much easier for Roger Goodell to come down last week for the RFK press conference, and it makes it much easier for him to come down yesterday for that for the Oval Office ceremony. And so it's that's just something as a local kid that still is just like wild to see.
if there are a million people, and by the way, you know, a lot of those people will be the same people that are there on night one, right? I mean, when they say a million, it's the three days of attendance in aggregate, but a lot of those people are going all 3 days. Do you have any information on what percentage is projected to be from outside the DMV?
You know, I haven't seen that, but I, again, like if you go, anybody that looks at the draft, you know, when they there are pockets of fans from every single city there.
Right.
This is a destination place that people want to go to, and so you know, Green Bay and Lambeau was a destination. Nashville was a destination, and I really believe like Washington D.C. and the National Mall is going to be something that is going to be a destination that's going to draw people in. So they can go to the event and then do, you know, whatever they want to do outside of it.
You know, back to the TV. By the way, I asked that question because that's going to be the real economic driver. Not that, you know, people from the DMV being downtown spending money, but the hotels and the you know, restaurants for people from out of town for 3 days. Let's just call it, if it's a third of the audience from out of town, that's significant to the city economically.
Oh, absolutely, and even like locally, you get, it becomes like a bachelor party weekend almost, where you get people that come into the city. Maybe they won't go out, and then they'll grab a hotel. So it's a, you know, anytime, and DC can handle these crowds. It handles these crowds these types of crowds all the time. So it's not going to tax the local market here.
Yeah, we're talking to John Orand. The bachelor party, the Nashville draft was the bachelorette party. That's the bachelorette
that's
party
right.
of capital of the United States. By the way, back to the TV ratings with Shadur. What was interesting about what you said, and it's totally, you know, logical and intuitive, but how many people were knocking ESPN, knocking Mel Kiper for focusing so much on the Shadur Sanders? And I was sitting there thinking to myself, you guys don't get it. This is what's driving the continued massive ratings. And as long as he doesn't get picked, it'll continue to be that. But there was a lot of criticism of ESPN's coverage in particular. Did you take note of that?
I did take note of that, and I unwarranted criticism. As somebody that, you know, comes up with columns all the time, that was the storyline. I mean,
yeah.
Somebody who drops out of the first round into the fifth round, and not only just somebody that drops that far, but Deion's son, of course that's a storyline. It's a massive storyline. But one of the things I love about the draft is that, you know, the hardcore fans are watching NFL Network. Pretty passionate fans are watching ESPN. And I love having ABC on because it's something that, like, I referenced my wife earlier. Like, she'll come in and she likes those sort of stories that they weave about these players. So the draft is so unique because it really is just somebody going to the podium and calling names, but they're able to get three different productions that are tailored to three different segments of the audience. And it's turned into just a massive deal. It's really incredible. If you think about it,
it's really so incredible. It is the single biggest non-game sports event that's carried and watched, right? There's not even a close second. Am I missing one? That isn't,
I don't think
a game.
You're missing anything. No. And if you look at the NFL, the combine doesn't get anywhere close to that in terms of TV numbers, but it does okay for you know,
right.
Watching people run up and down the field. You referenced the schedule release. People are going to tune in to watch. They've turned the schedule release into a day of programming. The whole idea. The NFL years ago set out to try to be a 12-month a year sport, and what they needed is what they call in the business sort of flagpoles to do it. The NFL draft obviously is a flagpole, and they've turned the schedule release into a mini flagpole. They've turned the combine into the mini flagpole. The start of training camp is going to be another one, and then we're going to be off and running again. The NFL. Everything that they've done from a media standpoint over the past, you know, 20, 25 years has just been, it's turned out to be gold.
I remember when it was first, you know, televised, you know, and it was on ESPN, and this is before a lot of us even had cable, and you're like, oh my God, I just want the cable to watch the draft. And all of that is so interesting, and I've talked about this every year, John. it's for something that we as football fans and even the people that are paid to do this get wrong the most. Like, two-thirds of the players picked will ultimately not amount to much in the NFL, but it's just something riveting about these few days. All right. So
if you talk to yeah. the ESPN executives, they would be really upset that all I did is reference the Sanders storyline, because they said for the first time in I forget how long, in a while, every single team had a first round pick, and the idea that you had like 32 fan bases all like with hope, you know, and that they're convinced that also helped drive viewership this year, because every team was involved, and you're hoping that your team gets better, and you're sitting around and watching that. So there's so many different great storylines about this that I think are pretty cool.
All right. Week from tomorrow night, and usually we don't get the date, and we got it during the draft, the actual schedule release date. Usually they kind of pop up, you know, 3 days before, and they're like, all right, it's going to happen on Thursday night. But they scheduled this out for some reason. Maybe it's done. I had this guy, Mike North, on my show maybe 3 weeks ago, John.
Yeah.
Excellent guest, in you know how much I love that stuff, and you love that stuff too. And one of the things he said is, you know, it sometimes isn't done until, you know, completely done until the commissioner signs off on it, and sometimes that's not until a few days before. But they obviously put it out there well in advance. I'm curious, do you know why they did it that way this year?
I'm not sure. I mean, maybe the computers are involved a little bit more. I'm going to cop to something here where several years ago, probably about 10 years ago, I had a great source that worked in the NFL that said, hey, you'll look smart if you put this out as the date that we're going to release the schedule. And I published it, and it was dead wrong. I was like, yeah. What happened? And just like North told you, like, the schedule wasn't ready. You know, they went through and they noticed like somebody had four road games in a row, and they had to, you know, and the you can't just like mix that up. There's a whole matrix that's there, and they do it. They still do it. They rely on computers, of course, and AI and all that stuff, but they still do a lot of it by hand, and it just wasn't ready. So the idea that they announced a date during the draft, I found to be particularly surprising, and I'm curious to see if they are able to hit it, or if there's going to be some sort of a jumble coming up in the run-up to it.
I was thinking that they probably figured out there's some benefit to really pre-selling it, you know, especially
totally,
during
yeah.
the draft.
Yeah, of course. I mean, from sponsorships to advertising
yeah.
to just getting the fans involved. I mean, if you look at those numbers for the draft and the numbers for the schedule release, the NBA playoffs are great, and they're fun, and they have big stars and big brands, and people still watch the drafts in droves over the NBA.
Right. Yeah. All right. So what do you I asked this guy, Mike North. I said, I guess the Washington conversation in schedule making this year is different than it's been. He said completely different. So have you thought about, you know, the prime spots for Washington, international games, holiday games at all?
I'm not sure about holiday games. I know that there's the max number of games. I think it's six, or is it eight?
Six for prime time, not counting flex.
Six for prime. And the thing that Washington has on its side is it's coming off a great year. Jaden Daniels appears to be a star, and the NFL likes that. This is a burgeoning franchise with a dormant fan base that the NFL really likes. Again, you've seen Roger Goodell in town with this team's owner the past 2 weeks. I would be shocked if they didn't max out in terms of primetime appearances.
Do you have any thoughts on who Philly opens up with on the Thursday night, September 4th or 5th or whatever it is, for the first game of the year?
Three
NFC East teams, right? Detroit, Giants, Skins, and Cowboys, and then they've got Detroit, Chicago, Denver, the Raiders, and the Rams.
Detroit, Chicago. Detroit's always up there. I wouldn't be surprised if they did an NFC East there. That's the one area. Because I used to do this all the time where I would predict the Thanksgiving games, and I was always pretty good on that. But there's been a thought where they don't like to put the best rivalry games on Thanksgiving anymore because people are going to watch no matter what. And even if you put a big game in, they want to make sure that they lead on that opening Thursday night with a big game. And so that to me would suggest that you would get a Philly, possibly a Philly Commanders game to open the season. Although I haven't heard anything in terms of that, but I would think like an NFC East foe would make a lot of sense because they do like to start the schedule with interdivision matchups and then end the schedule with the interdivision matchup. So that would make a lot of sense there, but I don't have any inside knowledge on that.
Get ready, people. There are going to be some late nights next year. That's for sure.
We're talking bleary eyes on Tuesday and some Monday mornings.
Tuesdays, Fridays, and Mondays. Yeah,
Fridays. We're talking. Adam in.
Talking to John Orand. So you talked about something on your recent podcast. You said was Goodell's Oval Office visit yesterday a peacekeeping mission for the league. What is it specifically that they're trying to keep peace with when it comes to this administration?
As we're talking right now, there are representatives from the NBA, the NHL, and baseball that are sitting in front of the Senate Commerce Committee, which is chaired by Ted Cruz. And he asked Roger Goodell or somebody from the NFL to appear on this hearing as well. And the NFL said, no, we're not doing it. And one of the things that Ted Cruz does on not just Ted Cruz, but the Senate Commerce Committee does is the idea of the antitrust exemption that the NFL has is always a lever that politicians try to use to extract something out of the league, or even just threatening to take it away. And we know the long history that Donald Trump has with the NFL, from trying to even get in the 80s when he was with the USFL, and then, you know, the Anthem Gate and Colin Kaepernick and everything having to do with that. The idea that Roger Goodell was in the Oval Office with Donald Trump just after saying no to Ted Cruz is nobody knows. It's impossible to predict what will happen, but that was a pretty big statement to me of that he's doing what is necessary to maintain this antitrust exemption that the NFL has.
What is the NFL doing to put that antitrust exemption at risk?
One of the things that they're doing. So one of the things that the Commerce Committee is up in arms about is, you know, the idea that if you want to watch NFL games on Christmas Day, you have to buy Netflix. You have to have a Netflix account. And if you want to see the opening Friday night game from Brazil, you know, you're going to have, you know, maybe a YouTube account, YouTube or something along those lines. If you want to watch a Thursday night game, you have to have Amazon. And they said the point of the antitrust exemption is that, like, this should be available to the most people. Like, you're making people buy all these different streaming services, you know, in addition to cable, for goodness sakes. Like, and it's great for the league. The league's making a ton of money. It's not very good for the fans. And so that's why the antitrust exemption might be up. I don't think it is up, by the way. I don't think there's a prayer that they're going to take it away in the near future. But again, sort of with this administration and you know, if the NFL does something that runs afoul of the administration, like, that could easily happen.
Well, I'm just curious, and maybe you don't have the answer to this, but what does the NFL business model look like without it?
Oh, that's going to be totally fascinating. So let's take the broadcasting for one. Right now, the NFL has it controls all of the all the league. All the teams' media rights, and so it's able to create these packages and say, Fox, here are your games, and CBS, here are your games, et cetera, et cetera. If the antitrust exemption goes away, all of a sudden the teams are able to say, like the Cowboys can say, we're going to sell the rights to our home games. And there's going to be a bidding war for those rights. And the Commanders will be able to say to sell the rights to their home games. The worst case scenario is the Jaguars are going to sell the rights to their home games. And I joked in my newsletter that, you know, Cheddar would be the one to pick up the Jaguar rights, you know, after Fox and Netflix and everybody is falling over themselves to get the Cowboys rights. And you would end up with the haves and the have-nots in a big way, even worse than we see right now in Major League Baseball.
Got it. Talking to John Orend. All right, last one, just out of curiosity. How are the NBA and NHL playoffs doing so far?
In terms of television, the NBA is doing great. This is a really important postseason for the NBA, in my opinion, just because, you know, LeBron's getting old and Steph Curry's getting old and like Jimmy Butler. And this is a chance for Cleveland and OKC and Minnesota and these teams that have these really good young stars to start to become a better known to the sporting public. And so far what we've seen, and a lot of this is driven because LeBron James and the Lakers have been in and Steph Curry and the Warriors, the ratings are up like a double digits right now in terms of the NBA. The NHL is not doing as well. It's not doing well at all, actually, in terms of a viewership. But a lot of that you can lay at the feet of the fact that there are a lot of Canadian teams that are still playing, and they don't rate well in the States. It's a good news, bad news scenario for the NHL. I think the NHL is doing fine. I think the business behind the NHL is as good as it's been in years. But television ratings for these playoffs are not doing well in the U.S.
Don't you think if we get Oklahoma City, Cleveland, that is a disaster for the NBA?
No, I don't think it's a disaster. Do I think it's going to get potentially the lowest finals ever in terms of viewership? Yes. But the NBA just signed 11-year deals, so they can afford to have a disaster now if they're able to seed these players so people know who they are. So I think we agree. Yeah, it'll be a disaster. Nobody will watch, but enough people will be watching that I think they'll be fine with that.
Yeah, to your point, like they've already been paid for the next 11 years or whatever it is. They're in good shape.
12 years. It's 11 years after 12. This. Exactly. Yeah.
Oh, my God. So getting Shai Gilgeous-Alexander and getting some of the, you know, an Anthony Edwards, getting one of them into the finals and starting to let people know who these guys are, and they're the next, you know, LeBron and Steph of the league. Yeah. At the same time, wouldn't shock me if we end up with Jokic or Steph in the finals. We'll see.
You can't kill him. You can't kill him.
Certainly, no, especially Steph. Thanks for doing this. Always enjoy it. Hope you're well.
All right. 1 to 10. 10 means you're totally optimistic. Buzz Williams. I'm at a 10 right now.
Yeah. I mean, look what he's done. You know, there are two things that strike me so far. Number one is his former players love him. You can't find anybody that's worked with him or played for him that doesn't swear by him. Number two is it's a transfer portal class that right now is ranked in the top 12, and then he just signed a 5-star player as a freshman the other day. So next year, which was written off by every Maryland fan after, you know, the debacle to end the season, may be a competitive season. Anyway, you just don't know. Every year's a new roster, so we'll see what happens. Do you think
that is 12
new players? But this year's team was essentially all new players, you know, with the exception of Reese. Do you think did it hurt the tournament this year? Is it hurting college sports that we have basically no consistency with players and teams year to year, or do we just adapt?
I think it is starting to hurt a little bit. And I think, again, I mentioned this with the ABC telecast of the NFL draft. People like you and me are going to learn these 12 new players. We're going to go to the games and we're going to support them, and it's going to be fun. What about not the people that aren't hardcore but are kind of fans? Like, you need to go on the kind of run that Maryland went on for them to buy into it. And so I think that's where it's going to get harder and harder, is to get the mid-casual fans to start to buy into some of these teams, because they don't know any of these players.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, we've talked about this many times before, but college basketball is essentially, for sports fans, become a one-month sport, period. And
yeah,
they didn't know in recent years, even if players were consistent year to year with teams, they didn't. They know the uniforms and the brands that are the teams and the uniforms in the sport, and sometimes the coaches more so than the players anyway. That's really been the case for a long time anyway, don't you think?
Yeah, but now you're seeing the coaches like leaving, so you're having to get to yeah. Like, Coach K isn't around anymore, and Jay Wright's not around anymore, and Laren Agan isn't around True. Anymore, and so also, like, they don't like how basketball is progressing. I think they're in the process of solving it. I'm curious to see how that works, but it's not going to happen for the next season or two.
All right, thank you. Talk to you soon. Appreciate it, John.
Anytime. See you. Bye.
John Orand, everybody, at Orand _ Puck. John's the best on sports business, sports media, etc. All right, I went and actually graded Washington's draft. Somebody basically asked me to do it to settle a bet. So I'll give you my Washington draft grade a week after the draft ended next. This from Martin. Martin wrote me last week. He said, Kevin, so you don't want to grade the draft. I have a bet with a friend of mine that you really liked their draft. So let's play a hypothetical game. I give you $1,000 to give me an honest grade, and you take the money and give the grade. Please play along. So Martin's got a friend who's he's got a bet with that I really like the draft. I'm not going to take your money, Martin. It's hypothetical anyway. Look, I'm fine with giving a grade on the draft. It's just such an exercise that every year when you see these people, you know, and everybody's got a grade, you just have to understand that they have no idea. It's easy to go back and audit the draft choices per team and to come to, you know, the answer, which is they're wrong essentially two-thirds of the time. The grading on the drafts is probably wrong two-thirds of the time as well. It's hard to grade a draft when you haven't seen any of these players play it down yet. Again, I've said this many times. If your grade is simply based on where they drafted him and if they got good value for the pick, meaning that guy was supposed to be picked a lot earlier and they got him a lot later, good value pick, or bad value pick, that guy was supposed to go much later, they picked him much earlier. You know, there's not even really in a draft like the one just completed a major consensus on the, you know, round, you know, equaling the player in terms of what's projected after the first maybe seven or eight picks. There was such a feeling among the draft experts, and even teams said this, that, you know, players 5 through 55 were basically interchangeable. So anyway, I went back and I did this for you, Martin. So I'm going to do it. And I did it player by player with this understood. Like, overall, I love that they invested in Jaden Daniels with a pick in the first round that improves their offensive line, theoretically. Investing in the trenches with a player like Connor Lee Jr. Investing in a corner, in which corners are super important to defensive performance in today's game. So that to me was kind of a positive overall that you can take away from what they did. And I also love that I believe that this is true. I love that they're drafting the best player available in the spot in which their pick comes up, because I think they're in position to do that. They're good enough, but they're not great yet. They have a lot of needs. So it's not like they were a player or two away from being, hey, this team's the Super Bowl favorite. You know, if they get the best pass rusher in the draft, or if they get the best corner in the draft, or if they sign the best running back in the draft. Not true. they had needs at almost every position other than quarterback. So they, I think, did what they did last year and what they said they would do this year, which I believe in, which is best player available. What I didn't love about this draft is, you know, because the draft is so inexact, because there's much more wrong that gets picked than right, because they did have, you know, significant needs, it would have been great had they traded back and accumulated more picks and gotten more swings than just five. You know, if you consider 35% to be an average hit rate on a draft, you'd rather that 35% be on 10 players than 5 players, because you're going to end up with more contributors. Now, they weren't going to get up to 10 picks, but they did have an opportunity late in the first round to trade back, at least according to Adam Peters, and I bet they had other opportunities to trade back as well. So getting just 5 picks, we knew that going in, we were hoping that they would end up with more, and not getting one of the, I think, significant needs that they have. But what do I know? Because they may feel totally differently about the players that are currently in-house. They may feel like, you know, we're okay with Dorrance Armstrong and with Dietrich Wise and with Javon Kinlaw and with Deron playing, you know, in the second year of this system, etc., to have a really good pass rush and a really good defense. But they didn't get, you know, a potential major impact defensive player on the defensive line, specifically a defensive edge, you know, a defensive end slash edge. So with that in mind, here are my thoughts on the players, starting with Connerly Jr. Again, love that they're investing in protecting their number one asset, which is Jaden Daniels. I like that they invested in the trenches. I like the athleticism of the player. I like that Cliff Kingsbury wanted him so much. I like that they also filled a need. Yeah, it was very clear with the trade for Laremy Tunsil that they didn't view Brandon Coleman as a starting left tackle. And it's pretty clear, given that he was the best player on the board and that they, if you take them for their word, they were hoping he would slide to them after a while, that they didn't view Brandon Coleman as a starting right tackle. So investing in the trenches, in the division they're in the situation they're in, trying to compete with Philadelphia, which is very strong on their defensive front, very strong defensively overall, the athleticism of this potential player, the fact that they picked him before all of the highly rated offensive linemen were gone. The Simmons went to Kansas City at the end. By the way, I did see that video of Howie Roseman looking to trade up in that first round with Washington. If you haven't seen that video, do you have that sound? I'm curious. I didn't ask you before the show, Max.
I can get it in a matter of like 30 seconds.
Yeah, if you can get it, that'd be great for those that haven't heard it. Basically, Howie Roseman recorded in the draft room in Philadelphia, making a call, by the way, for the second straight year to Washington. There was a trade made in the second round last year between Washington and Philadelphia. This year, he was looking to trade up to 20. 29. He wanted Jihad Campbell, the linebacker out of Alabama. This was his call to Adam Peters.
Where are you?
Hey, buddy. How we doing? Yeah, it's a tradition. I feel like we should keep it keeping trades. Any interest in a small move back? Let's see. He said there's an in-division tax. He really didn't want to do a trade with me.
With the 29th pick in the 2025 NFL Draft, the Washington Commanders select Josh Connerly Jr.
Here we go.
Tackle, Oregon.
Still okay. Connerly.
It's a great pick.
That last comment from Howie Roseman, great pick. I guess it's nice to hear that from Howie Roseman. Tried to trade back, trade up, which would have been from 32 to 29. Now, Philadelphia did make a trade with Kansas City to move up one spot after this conversation with Washington. Washington didn't want to trade back. Now, Philly wanted Jihad Campbell. That's who, the player they wanted. And Washington, I guarantee you, felt like trading back to 32, which is what would have happened in that spot, to pick up maybe a third rounder for the move, that they would have lost Connerly Jr. maybe to Kansas City, who was scheduled to pick at 31 before the trade with Philadelphia. I don't think they wanted to risk it. I think they really legitimately wanted Josh Connerly Jr. and knew that if they traded back even just from 29 to 32 in that spot, that there was a chance that they would lose him. So there's just a lot there, you know, that confirms that Adam Peters wasn't, you know, BSing us when he said we had opportunities, plural, he said, to move back and not that far. I thought maybe Kansas City was the team moving up to 29. Maybe they were too, but now we know Philadelphia was interested in trading up to 29. And yeah, you know, already since Adam Peters took over, there have been a couple of trades with Philadelphia. A draft day trade last year where Washington picked up 2 seconds but gave up a second, which became Cooper DeJean for Philadelphia. Washington had ended up becoming San Ristil and Ben Sinnott in the second round, right? I think that's what it was. And then obviously Washington traded Jahan Dotson to Philly as well during training camp. But I think Washington didn't trade back because they were fearful of losing Connerly Jr. So anyway, back to the grading of the draft. I like that Connerly Jr. was picked by Washington. I think I like the player. I admit, offensive line, very tough for most fans to really and truly evaluate. Cooley loved Connerly Jr., said super athletic. Just the athleticism alone against some of the best defensive players, including guys like Abdul Carter that he faced in college, meant that without question, he looked the part of a first-round pick. I give the Connerly pick an A. Trey Amos, look, they picked a guy at the end of the second round that was projected by many to go in the first round, worst case, early second round. So based on that, the value looks good. I like the player. I talked about this player before the draft. I liked a few of the other corners as well and maybe a little bit more, but I trust them on the fit. Cornerbacks, like offensive linemen, are hard for us to analyze because so much of it is fit and scheme dependent. But I'll give that pick an A. So there you go. The first two picks, A. Jalen Lane. I didn't know much about Lane, but I'm impressed. You know, he's athletic. He's got great speed. He's a true vertical threat, you know, especially with a quarterback that can throw the football. He's also a weapon, you know, because of all of the reverses and jet sweeps and screens at the line of scrimmage that he ran at Virginia Tech. You know, he's also a punt returner. So I think the value was fine. I liked a few receivers a lot more, but they were all gone by the time Washington got to their fourth round pick. Washington didn't have a third rounder. I liked the Jalen Lane pick. I give it a B. Kane Medrano was the player that after the draft, I really loved the player as much as a fan can love a player's highlight reel for the most part. The value in the sixth round, you know, based on kind of a back of the envelope consensus before the draft, the value was fine. I personally don't know what he is. He might be a safety. He actually has the build of more of a safety, but he played a lot of linebacker. I love the athleticism. I love the, you know, relative athletic scores of this draft. That should have been something I also mentioned as kind of an overview, big takeaway. In that I do like that they certainly have this idea that they want more athleticism, more team speed. And I thought team speed was something they needed to improve here in the offseason anyway. But I loved watching Kane Medrano's anticipation feel and talent. He did have some issues with tackling at times and missed tackles, sometimes overplaying the anticipation, being there, but maybe a bit too early. But I thought that this player, based on where they got him and his athleticism and his feel for the game, was B plus A minus. So far, I like all the players. And then lastly, Jacory Kroski-Merritt. There's something about this pick that I bet you guys didn't know. I'll share that with you when we come back. Kevin Sheehan Show, the Team 980, the team980.com. We're free and live on the Odyssey app.
All right, yesterday, too much rain. The Nats had their game postponed yesterday, and they will re-rack and take on the Cleveland Guardians twice in a doubleheader right here on the Team 980 pregame with Charlie and Dave. Starts at 3:05. Two thrilling NBA finishes last night. The Knicks rally from a 20-point deficit to beat the Boston Celtics in overtime 108-105, and the Nuggets fight back and steal a win off the Oklahoma City Thunder. Jokic put up 42 points and 22 rebounds. Clemson and Notre Dame football programs have announced a home-and-home series set to begin in 2027. The two college football titans will face off through 2038, and the series will work independently of the ACC structure and does not count towards one of Notre Dame's five ACC games. The Washington Capitals will take on the Carolina Hurricanes after nearly a week off pregame at 6:45 on 106.7 The Fan. Logan Thompson expected to get the start. This update is sponsored by the Team 980 YouTube page. Just open the app, type in the Team 980 and hit subscribe. Kevin Sheehan is live from 10 to 1 and Craig Hoffman from 4 to 7. Don't forget to like the stream and turn on notifications to stay up to date on all things DC sports. And that's what's trending.
So Jacori Kroski-Merritt, their seventh round selection from Arizona, player who only played one game at Arizona. You have to go back to the 2023 Jacori Kroski-Merritt New Mexico stuff to really get a feel for the player. But before I tell you just thoughts on the player and give it a grade, I went back last week and just looked at all of the seventh round running backs over the last 10 years of the NFL draft, not including, of course, the draft just finished. 33 running backs have been taken in the seventh round over the last 10 years of the NFL draft. And just one out of 33 has had an impact. Isaiah Pacheco, seventh round, Rutgers to KC in 2022. That's it. That's the list. Seventh round running backs just don't really produce much. It is a long shot to land on a significant contributing running back in the seventh round. Yes, I do know that this draft in particular was a very deep running back draft. And maybe the chances are greater because the evaluation of running backs in this draft was that there were a lot of them and a lot of them were very much the same. And so teams were going to wait until the final day of the draft to start taking running backs. But I thought that was interesting. Now, there are a couple of undrafted free agents. Rico Dowdle was an undrafted free agent in the league right now. He's making, you know, a contribution. He's a pretty good back, actually. You know, in our history, Alfred Morris was a sixth-round pick. But basically, seventh-round running backs, for the most part, just like seventh-round anything, you know, it's a long shot. You know, it just typically doesn't happen. You know, I'm reminded of when, you know, I mentioned about the just looking at, you know, probability-based past history with Sam Howell being picked in the fifth round. It was a needle in a haystack that he was going to end up being a guy that was drafted at that point, passed over by so many teams with needs in a draft that didn't have any quarterbacks, that somehow he was going to end up being a find. Didn't eliminate the chance that it could be, you know, a find, like the find of the century, like, you know, the Kurt Warner undrafted, you know, Arena League story. But just telling you, one out of 33 in the last 10 years, seventh round running backs, Isaiah Pacheco. He's the best of the lot, and it's not even close. And he's far from a great back. I love Pacheco, though. He runs so hard. He's good. You know, he's a good back. He's not an elite back, but he's a really good back. But he's not in the upper tier of backs. Now, on Jacori Kroski-Merritt, didn't know anything about him until they picked him. I would have been thrilled had they figured out a way to get a few other guys, maybe a trade up into the early part of the seventh round to take the guy that I had talked about all spring and even going back to college football seasons the last 2 years, Damian Martinez, who, by the way, on multiple lists of the biggest steals in the draft, he was listed on almost every one of them, being taken early in the seventh round by Seattle. I love Taj Brooks and Devin Neal. They both went in the sixth rounds, but I think Merritt looks good on tape. The New Mexico stuff looks good. You know, maybe he's the guy after Genty that turns into the star. Who knows? But, you know, he's quick. He's fast. He's, you know, got good cutting ability, decent vision. We'll see. I mean, to me, it's a B-minus, C-plus pick. Really hard to know. But overall, on the five picks, I gave Connerly Jr. an A. I gave Amos an A. I gave Lane a B. I gave Medrano B-plus, A-minus. And I gave Kroski Merritt B-minus, C-plus. It probably averages out to like an A-minus, B-plus draft. So to Martin, who asked me to do this to settle a bet with a friend, I think I just won you money. Wouldn't you consider an A-minus, B-plus draft, Max, to be a good evaluation of the draft?
Yeah, A-minus, B-plus, that's pretty much where I've seen. I mean, that's where it lands for me. That's where I've seen it land for a bunch of people around here. And that's what I've been hearing throughout the national media. So I think you got it right.
Well, I didn't get it right.
Well, I mean, nobody can get it right.
That's what I'm giving out.
You're on par.
We may have gotten it right. We may have gotten it right.
Let's hope so.
But we'll know in the year 2028. We'll know 2 years before the new stadium opens,
man,
and a year after Washington hosted the draft. Speaking of Washington hosting the draft, some of my thoughts on this, and I want some of yours at 301-230-0980. Are you excited that Washington got the draft? Will you attend in 2027 the draft? Phone lines are open, 301-230-0980. Kevin Sheehan Show, Team 980, the team980.com. By the way, if you've never seen pro rugby live, this is your chance to change that. Tuesday night, May 13th at 6 p.m., Old Glory DC takes on NOLA Gold at George Mason University Stadium. Big hits, fast breaks, 80 minutes of nonstop action, and tickets are just $15. It's Old Glory's biggest military salute ever. Free tickets at the gate for service members with a valid ID. And author Martin Pegler will be signing Brotherhood when West Point Rugby went to war. Get your tickets now at Old Glory DC.com and let's scrum together.